This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio with me is our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
As everyone knows, the United States is involved in several military actions around the world. And at times, depending on your stance, you are either supportive of them or not. And boy, this spring and summer in Washington, we've seen quite a hullabaloo over when you can and when you cannot use force in other parts of the world.
And what is a war and what isn't
right.
A war, and when certain laws apply and when certain laws don't apply. Of course, the current administration coming in and saying that the drawdown was required in Iraq, but then Afghanistan needed to be built up. And most recently, of course, Afghanistan needs to be drawn down and how we're going to deal with that. But I believe what's really caught my attention in the last few weeks has been this question of whether the War Powers Act applies to Libya. And both sides of the aisle trying to employ this legal document to compel the chief executive to make a decision.
Can we have a little background on what the War Powers Act is?
The War Powers Act is one of many of the Watergate era pieces of legislation that were designed to limit the powers of the presidency that had at that point been most recently expanded by Richard Nixon. Now, Nixon was the inheritor of a series of steps by his predecessor presidents, roughly from the beginning of the Second World War, in which each president sought to expand their discretion in many ways. But Vietnam, of course, was a contentious war for this nation, and with Richard Nixon's other excesses being exposed, the War Powers Act was basically created to force the president when a declaration of war was not made, and I'm vastly oversimplifying for the sake of today's argument, that the president must come report to Congress if he is going to commit American military forces, which then becomes also another definition in this, to war. And that's where we're at right now, is what is war?
The idea being one person unable to sustain a military operation without the support of the elected body of Congress.
Well, and of course, Congress wishing to see the president to stand before that body and ask for declarations of war. We haven't had a all-on declaration of war roughly since the Second World War. Harry Truman, very famously, taking the United States into the Korean conflict, which, of course, was a police action, his opponents in Congress wishing to force that issue. But less pushback on it because, of course, this is the height of Red Scare 2. But it reminds me of our great neutrality debates and one of the most at the time significant, but in retrospect whimsical, attempts to outlawry of war.
Just to say it was illegal.
Yes.
To commit an act of war.
And that was the key word. I've always loved that word. The outlawry of war through the Kellogg-Briand Pact.
The Kellogg-Briand Pact.
This has nothing to do with Battle Creek, Michigan.
Battle Creek, Michigan.
Yes.
Yeah. Kellogg-Briand?
Yes. Aristide Briand was the French foreign minister in the 30s, and the United States Secretary of State was Frank Kellogg. Briand, in the attempt to give France better protection and stability after the First World War, was hoping to have an alliance with the United States of sorts, and it would start off with the attempt to have France and the United States say that these two nations would pledge to never go to war against each other, that they would always resolve their differences through arbitrations or diplomatic means.
Yeah, that's a great goal. That's
exactly.
A fantastic goal.
It was a fantastic goal, and it sounds like something that how could you be against? But Frank Kellogg, of course, was not in favor of it because Kellogg saw through a little bit of what Briand was really hoping to achieve. He wanted to see the United States tied to France in somewhat of a inverted military alliance. Well, if we agree to not have this kind of conflict against each other, if one of us gets in those time of conflicts, we could call on our friend to come in and help us. So Kellogg, not wanting to also limit the American options, what if we decided to go to war with France and we wanted to, came up with the equally brilliant political maneuver in responding to Briand, who was carrying it to the public and obviously is getting great positive support, great support among politicians in the country. keep in mind, this is the era after the meat grinder that was the First World War, mm-hmm. and the great era of fear and loathing of all things military because of the shock and awe, probably more genuine than shock and awe as we think of the First World War. So,
because the thought was the next one could just end everything.
Kellogg decides that this concept is too important to be merely limited to two nations. Mm-hmm. Why we should extend it to any nation in the world that wished to join in. At this point, Aristide Briand probably expressing the French version of "Don't!" because now he
calls your bluff.
Yes. And in quick succession, all the leading nations of the earth were going to sign on to the Kellogg-Briand Pact and declare that they would no longer resort to war to settle their differences. I think it's a notable thing to go through the roster of some of the nations that did sign on.
They were?
That would be France, mm-hmm. United States,
sure.
Germany,
hmm.
Japan,
hmm.
Italy,
hmm.
Great Britain. You see my point.
The big players.
All the players signed on, and many of the minor ones by the time it was done. I believe 62 or 63 nations, which in a 300-plus nation world that we live in today does not sound as significant. But remember, this is also the era
of empires.
Still the great empire. So many of the nations that would be independent now really were signatories to it. So, yes, you then have the delicious ironies of the Sino-Japanese conflict that begins in 1937. No, there was no war because they were signatories to the Kellogg-Briand Pact.
So they were having a conflict.
They were having a conflict and because they had declared that war was illegal.
So obviously this wasn't war.
It obviously wasn't a war.
Neither side thought it was a war.
Absolutely no
Because war. They both signed this.
Which then, of course, leads us to the Neutrality Acts in the United States during the 1930s that carry you through another series of these. Just amusing when you look back on it, but it was dead serious politics at the time, and it is a little bit facetious on our part to pick fun at it, but you start in 1935 with the desire of the United States Congress, again, an isolationist movement to make darn sure we got Kellogg-Briand in place, but we don't want any Americans getting involved in these conflicts in Europe and these conflicts in Asia that are brewing, and Italy and Ethiopia are at war, and we want to make sure that we are going to be truly neutral on both sides. So, you know, the United States, in the event of a state of war, mm-hmm. will be strictly neutral. We'll not trade with either side. Also because, of course, during the First World War, we declared that we were neutral, but we would trade with either side. It's just that, you know, there was this thing called the British Navy, kind of got in the way of Imperial Germany mm-hmm. being able to trade with us. So we ended up trading with one side. Wasn't our fault.
Wasn't our fault, right.
Well, now we're going to solve that. We just won't trade with either side. Great. Well, the next year in 1936, when the Spanish Civil War kicks off mm-hmm. and Americans are being involved on both sides. Remember, we have mm-hmm. Arkansas and Frank Tinker flying for one of the sides as a
Absolutely.
Mercenary pilot. We've talked about him in the past. Well, now what do you do? There's no, not only is there no declared war here, there's no war here. It's a civil war. There aren't two countries. You can't ban both sides. Whoops, we better have another Neutrality Act, so we're going to add 136 to take care of that. Well, the president was involved in deciding whether or not there was a war. Well, what happens in 1937 when we have the Sino-Japanese conflict that we mentioned and Franklin Roosevelt obviously not wanting to favor the Japanese because of Delano family ties in the backs to the Chinese and a certain amount of romanticized view in Washington toward many of the things that Chiang Kai-shek's government may or may not have represented. So we simply won't declare the war. Then we can't have the Neutrality Act of 35 involved because we're going to say there's no war, there's a conflict. Well, of course, Congress will respond to that and say, well, we will by other means decide whether or not there is a war. It just reminds me of, again, this sort of here we are again today, mm-hmm. you know, almost 70 years later with the same sort of machinations going back and forth of, well, now that piece of legislation doesn't apply because, well, we really can't define what a war is.
You know, we've made light of some of this, but it seems downright disheartening that you can have all the major powers in the world at one point agreeing, no. War is awful. It should be outlawed. And it doesn't even last for, you know, a few years.
Well, it I think speaks to a certain fantasy that we often place within our documents. And that was the argument at the time. It was one of the things that Frank Kellogg was thinking about. He won the Nobel Peace Prize anyway. And others would say is that you're trying to say that this piece of paper is really going to stop a sword. It's not. This is, regrettably, the state of human nature. There is going to be conflict. Often, that conflict escalates to armed conflict. It takes us back to the point today of in Libya. You just have to scratch your head and ask yourself, how exactly, again, if the military of a nation is involved against another nation, but that's not a war. Therefore, the War Powers Act doesn't apply.
Well, until we get everybody on the planet to agree what is or isn't a war,
we're history.